Hello world, I am Sanyadara and I'm sitting in the library at Ishtana, which is the most central retreat centre in Tirana. It's in Hereford, England. We are towards the end of a philosophy symposium. I'm in company of Devan, Sila Bardin and Dr. Matt Rage. And you three guys have been really taking us through a great journey of exploring Buddhist modernism. Yeah, could you take us through a bit of how the weekend's been? It started with maybe you, Devan.
Yeah, of course. Thanks, Sangadara. So we had a theme for this year's philosophy symposium, which was exploring Buddhist modernism. Firstly, we wanted to draw attention to how all of us as Buddhists in the West and elsewhere are modernist just by the fact that we participate in modernity. So although we believe we're Buddhists, we're by definition Buddhist modernists in that we're all participants in modernity. We're all affected, deeply conditioned and formed by the assumptions of the modern age. So broadly there's three kinds of areas in which of modernity we wanted to explore, and that's the effect of scientific naturalism, a whole new way of looking at the world that comes from the 17th century scientific revolution. There's the romantic expressivism movement, which was a reaction against the rationalism of the Enlightenment. And then there's the deep effect of the Protestant Reformation on our ways of thinking about religion. By definition, being a Buddhist in the modern day means being a Buddhist modernist and having some kind of engagement with these big themes in modernity. So we wanted to explore all this. And my contribution was a talk called Sangharakshita as Buddhist Modernist, the case of the five Niyamas. And I wanted to explore this somewhat unlikely sounding idea that Sangharakshita was a modernist. Of course, in a way, we're all modernists. Even more surprising, I wanted to explore how Sangharakshita's presentation of the Dharma actually engages very creatively with scientific naturalism, the worldview that comes from the discoveries of modern science. And I did that by discussing the background to his teaching of the five Niyamas, which is such a central part of his presentation of the Dharma. So I showed how the teaching of that, the order of cause and effect in the universe, the order of conditionality, can be understood as consisting of five levels, beginning with the Utu Niyama, the order of cause and effect on the level of physical, inorganic stuff, and then the Bija Niyama, the order of seeds or biological processes. And then the Chitta Niyama, the order of the mind, which broadly corresponds to psychology. So these three kinds of orders can be linked up with scientific rationalism. But it turns out that in the text from which this teaching comes, it's really not so clear that any modernist or scientific assumptions are being made. It was the interpretations of Mrs. Rhys-Davids and other early Buddhist writers who made this connection. And they did so quite naturally and spontaneously, believing that Buddhism really did have a contribution to make to modern culture. And Sangharakshita picked up on that and presented the Dharma in a way that sounds like it's completely compatible with science. Added to this scientific rationalism is the idea that there's also a Kama Niyama, a law of cause and effect connected with our ethical intentions. And further, there's a Dhamma Niyama, a way that the universe works, which is somehow connected with the goal of the Dharma, which is Buddhahood or awakening. And by linking in these two higher niyamas or orders of cause and effect, Sangharakshita's connected up the goal of Buddhism with science, but in a way that slightly goes beyond rationalism. It adds something else, something specifically Buddhist. And in that sense, it pushes back against the rationalist kind of assumptions of modernity. Of course, it turns out that this is not unconnected to the romantic strain in Sangharakshita's thought.
So yeah, that's why I come in. I did a talk on romantic Buddhism, I should say. I almost wanted to say Buddhist romanticism, but I explicitly mean it the other way around, because I think it's a form of Buddhism with a romantic flavor, so to speak, rather than the other way around. So my talk was about how we are very strongly conditioned by the romantic movement. So my main inspiration is from the German romantics. I quoted from Novalis. Well, originally he was called Friedrich von Hardenberg, but he had a mystic experience at the grave of his fiancée who died. And he had an experience of death and rebirth. And then when he came out of that, he gave himself the name Novalis, which means he who builds new lands. And he says the romantics were called on a mission to rebuild the earth. And the way to do that is by romanticizing it. So now I'm quoting Novalis. When I give a higher meaning to the ordinary, an appearance of mystery to the common, the dignity of the unknown to the known, the glow of infinity to the finite, then I romanticize it. So with this, well, like Bevan said, he was reacting against a sort of narrow-minded view of rationalism. He wanted to expand the notion of reason, of rationality. So he wanted to include the imagination in it. Well, not just he, but all the romantics. And so the more expanded view of reason that you could include, well, like you said, infinity in it, the unknown and the mysterious. So the imagination was very important for the romantics. So, well, they did this by way of science as well. Many people think the romantics were against science in some way, but that wasn't the case at all. In fact, Goethe, if I include him in the romantics, then he spent decades in studying plants. He was a botanist. He had a laboratory and with prisms, and he made an alternative color theory because he wasn't happy with Newton. So they were quite into science, but of course they were mostly into art. That's what they are most known for. And so this whole notion of you have to be authentic, you have to connect with your inner source of creativity, that's very romantic. My point was really that Bante was also quite a strong romantic. And there's been some criticisms about that, and not about Bante specifically, but about Buddhists being romantic. There's a book from the Tanisaro who's quite critical of it, and also criticisms within the movement that, we are just a romantic movement. Well, I think we are a romantic movement, but it's not. I'm quite happy about it. I'm quite happy to be in the company of Novalis and Goethe. Yeah, well, and of course, Bante was more an British romantic. He liked Shelley and Blake, and there's also a very strong Neoplatonist flavor connected with romanticism. Mm-hmm. Shelley was a Neoplatonist as well as a romantic. Yeah, so my point is really that we are romantic and we should be happy about it, and we should develop it more. Well, another aspect of romanticism, with that I give it to Matt. There was Schleiermacher, who also romanticized our notion of religion. And that is, so he defined religion as, religion is a sensitivity and a taste for the infinite. And in that way, so he drew the attention to personal experience in our religious life. And so, and with that, he had a strong influence, among others, on James, William James, who sort of grounded philosophy. And then Matt comes in.
Thanks, Silavardin. So yeah, that's a good place for me to start. I addressed an aspect of Buddhist modernism, which is in some schools of Buddhism in the West, maybe others more than Sri Ratnam, something's called the American, it's sometimes called the American Insight Movement, the Insight Meditation Movement, but certainly here in Sri Ratna as well, what we might call an experientialist way of thinking about Buddhism, about the Dharma, about the path, has really come into the ascendancy. And this is a quintessentially Buddhist modernist tendency. Long ago, before the Reformation, religion wasn't thought of as an experience. It was thought of a series of beliefs that you commit to, that you confess. It was confessional. And it was very much about things like obedience, duty, service, occupying a world full that was animated with devils, demons, non-human agents like spirits, and of course God controlling it all. Fast forward again to the 20th century, things have changed very, very dramatically. Religion, and this is where my talk picks up, religion, as Bhante Sangharakshita points out in his essay, Enlightenment as Experience and Non-Experience, starts to become a feeling, a sentiment, more than it becomes a credo, more than it is a credo. And in my talk, I use Bhante Sangharakshita's analysis of the way in which religion has come to be seen as an experience, as a way of understanding a very particular movement in Buddhist modernism, which is the secular mindfulness meditation movement. My PhD research, which I got to the end of a couple of years ago, was a historical and sociological analysis of the beginnings of the mindfulness meditation movement amongst Buddhist and what we might call Buddhist meditators in Massachusetts at the height of the New Age movement in the early to mid-1970s. Mid-1970s counterculture in Massachusetts was kind of LSD-drenched, filled with colourful guru figures like Ram Dass, with stories of travels to the East. And within this ferment of Westerners picking up Eastern meditation techniques, emerged an idea that fundamental to all of these techniques and practices was a particular kind of experience. And this very much came, as Sila Vardhan just pointed out, from the research of William James in the early 20th century, particularly his Varieties of Religious Experience, where he claimed there was a common thread or even a common essence to religion, which was the religious, the mystical religious experience. So in my talk, I use Bhante Sangharakshita's analysis of this experientialist tendency to unravel some of the threads of this experience-centered way of thinking about Dharma practice, to unravel those threads and maybe shine a light on how we still tend to privilege the idea of personal experience in our Dharma practice over what you might call more objective or less subjectivity-oriented modes. And Bhante talks about things like growth, duty and work. So I use Sangharakshita's teachings to have a closer look at some key tendencies within contemporary Buddhism, with the hope that it will enable us to be more reflective about how we think about the Dharma.
So you might have got a sense of how rich these talks were, of really, really exploring these different aspects of what it's involved on Buddhist and modernism, from Devan's scientific naturalism and the case of the five niyamas. And so if you want to hear more of that, do listen to that talk. And also, if you don't know anything about the romantics, Sila Vardhan's talk is great. And Matt's Protestant Informed Modernism. They're very good, engaging talks. And after the talks, we moved on into trying to place ourselves, isn't it, within the spectrum of what kind of Buddhist modernist we are.
Yes. So yesterday, we turned to getting our participants to join in with the question of asking themselves, what kind of Buddhist modernist am I? We devised a spectrum of Buddhist modernism, and at the bottom of this spectrum was the full-on liberal humanist. This is a child of the Enlightenment, a person of reason who's fully embraced such values of modernity as individualism, secularism, democracy, and more recently feminism, egalitarianism.
So someone who's at this end of the spectrum is a, you might call a Buddhist humanist or a humanist Buddhist. A Buddhist who is Buddhist only insofar as it fits in with democracy, equality, secularism, and so on.
And at the other end of our spectrum of Buddhist modernism is the person we call the neo-traditionalist. I think we could also describe this person as a sort of postmodern Buddhist. And this is somebody who's, whilst living in modernity, is not so convinced by the claims of rationalism, not so convinced by the other dogmatic sort of elements of the modern worldview.
And is likely to support the idea of spiritual hierarchies, believe in rebirth, very happy about accepting the idea there are deva realms and non-human agencies occupying the world, as it were, enchanting the world of our Dhamma practice, as well as really believing in classic institutional forms of Buddhism, for example, monasteries, or at least something approaching the traditional setting of Dhamma practice.
So we went further in seeing this spectrum in terms of three axes. So there's firstly the axis of authority. At one end of this axis is the authority of experience and reason alone.
That's at the liberal humanist end of the axis, by the way.
And at the other end, the neo-traditionalist end, is the authority of teachers and scriptures. Then the second axis is the axis of belief.
So the axis of belief, on the liberal humanist end of the axis, we have a naturalistic view of the world, that the physical, natural, material world, possibly more or less as described by science, but not necessarily, is all there is. On the other end of the belief spectrum is an acceptance of either the possibility or the actuality of vast realms of beings and experience and things, beings like bodhisattvas, many, many past Buddhas, devas, and so on. They're realities. They're not something that we just imagine. They're in the world in the same way as plants and tables and chairs are in the world.
Supernatural phenomena and non-human agents.
Supernatural phenomena and non-human agents, exactly.
So our third axis is the axis, I think this is, needs a bit more work, but on one end of the spectrum is the idea of the imminence of the goal of Buddhist practice, that whatever we mean by nirvana or awakening is to be understood in terms of this world, in terms of a human being embedded in the materiality and reality of this world, which is our only home.
And that's the humanist end of the spectrum. It was on the traditionalist end of the spectrum. And I keep being given the traditionalist one to talk about, which hints at our respective tendencies. At the traditionalist end of the spectrum, transcendence is really emphasised. The goal of the spiritual life is to go beyond this world. It's to touch the deathless, to become one with the unconditioned. And it really has very little, if anything at all, to do with the mundane, messy reality that we're forced to confront as humans.
So where were you on the spectrum, guys?
Well, so we used ourselves more as examples to clarify what we mean. So my it's on these three axes. So first the belief axis, from whether you believe in just natural facts or superhuman or extrahuman agency. Well, I would say I'm 7 or even 8. So I'm quite happy to believe in devas and kobolds and being in nature and fairies and all the rest of it. It's just as being there, I actually believe that. Although I don't experience them, you know, as clearly as I experience you guys, but you know, I do experience atmospheres and these sort of things. So I'm quite happy to allow that as a reality, and I think it's more I can't perceive them. You know, it's more like something that I missed and something that's not there. Well, and on the other spectrum, so I'm quite a neo-traditionalist there. If you would call it like that, and well, and on the immanence transcendent axis, I, you know, I'm very radically zero on I'm an immanent. You know, I don't think we there is, or we need a transcendent world. So for me, the natural is just all there is, you know, but natural is more than just material. So I would include all the fairies and the devas in the natural world, really. So, but you know, for me, nirvana is just being here and now in the natural world, just, you know, without a thirst. So without the grasping, it's actually a very beautiful and perfect world. So that's the other axis. And the third axis was authority. Yeah, sorry, yeah, the authority. So now I'm in that way, I'm more on the liberal side. So I'm quite keen on relying on my own authority of my reason and my own experience. So I'm like Kant, think for yourselves. Have the courage to think for yourselves. So, but at the same time, you know, I am inspired by the scriptures and drawn into their world, and I am inspired by teachers. So I do find them important, but my emphasis would be more on my own reason and experience. I would give myself a three on that scale. So 1, 3, and 7.
So the way this worked was as Sila Vardhan is kind of suggesting, with each axis, we gave it a score out of 10. And you add those up to get your total Buddhist modernist score out of 30. And the closer you are to 30, the more of a traditionalist or neo-traditionalist you are. And the closer you are to 0, the more of a liberal humanist you are. Of course, this isn't perfect, but for the sake of a light experiment, it was a lot of fun. So Sila Vardhan's score was, you had 3, 7, and 1, yeah, which is 11. So towards the liberal humanist end of the Buddhist modernist spectrum. Do you want to go next, Ivan?
Yeah, so the exercise really showed how differentiated and variegated the world of Buddhist modernism is. So on the modernometer, the modernometer, on the axis of authority, I scored 5. I very much rely on the authority of experience and reason, but I've always strongly responded to Buddhist, especially early Buddhist scriptures, and my experience with my friends and teachers in the Dharma has been so important that I have to acknowledge that too, just as strongly. So I'm right in the middle of that axis. And likewise with the immanence and transcendence axis. I think that if nirvana awakening means anything, it has to be meaningful in this world, our only world. And yet I'm not really a humanist. I think that awakening must be possible for any being, not just human beings. It's of a cosmic kind of significance. So again, I'm a 5. So far, I'm sitting on the fence. But when it came to the axis of belief, I had to put myself at 0, that I don't experience or don't believe in supernatural phenomena and non-human agents at all. Not only have I no experience of ghosts or goblins or fairies or bodhisattvas, but I don't expect to. I don't think they exist. So this has produced some shock and all amongst my friends and colleagues here. But what can one say? I live in the world of the philosopher Immanuel Kant, perhaps, who thought that human rationality was the source of all these rational beings. So I ended up scoring 11.
11.
Ten on the modernometer, a bit closer to liberal humanist end than Sila Vardhan.
I'm hesitating because of my... at least in this room, I feel somewhat embarrassed by my score, although I think I'm pleased with it in another way.
Be proud, Matt.
Yeah, okay, I'll be proud. So on the authority spectrum, on the authority axis, I scored 6 or 7. I'm going to go for 6.5. I was very strongly inspired when I first came along to Buddhism by the kindness and integrity of the teachers I encountered. And I had a very immediate faith response. The same happened when I first read Buddhist scriptures, especially the Heart Sutra, I just had a sense this is true. I didn't have to process it through reason or experience. It was as if there was some truth in the text and in the people who put it into practice that I just responded to. On the other hand, I've had a very strong and long academic training in philosophy, in history, in sociology. So reason and experience is very important to me. But I think when it comes to Dharma practice, faith in the authority of teachers and texts will always come first, to then be tested in reason experience. So I'm slightly over the middle ground towards the traditional end. I'm going to say 6.5. 7 seems too strong, 6 too little. When it comes to belief, I'm 9 in the direction of supernatural agencies, forces and beings. I've had what I believe, what I think are direct encounters with non-human beings, with possibly bodhisattvas, but certainly with lesser spirits on solitary retreat in meditation. And because of my tendency to have faith in what the scriptures say and in what teachers, in what my teacher Bhante Sangharakshita said, they say that these kinds of beings do exist and they've encountered them. It fits with my experience, so I have no reason not to believe they're there. So I'm going to say a 9, not 10, because there's always room for a little bit of doubt. You don't want to hold too tightly onto any view. So the last one is transcendence and immanence. And I tend to think very strongly in terms of transcendence. My own sense of what my teachers argue and my own experience of the Dharma is that it allows for a world completely transformed. It opens up realms of experience, realms of being that we're just not in touch with most of the time. Whilst finally, and this was a problem with this scale, the distinction between transcendence and immanence has to collapse because there's no final distinction between samsara and nirvana, I tend to think of the path quite strongly in terms of transcendence. So I'm going to go for a 9 on that, which brings me to a total of 24.5. And we tested about 30 people who came on this retreat, people across the whole range of the spectrum, but I'm afraid to say, the most traditional in the room. The next most traditional person was 21. I don't know if that's an achievement or an embarrassment, but it's what happened.
Yeah.
See, this exercise was really, it was fun as well as informative. I just wanted us to end up with maybe a quick word of a part of being fun and intellectually stimulating. What do you think it is important, the value of having a philosophy symposium?
Well, I think the most important thing is to clarify things, clarify distinction to make, because there are many things that are in the movement. People have views, but they're not aware of their views. Just to make people aware of their views, and which also there tends to be a lot of taking sides in the movement. So I think this and you think that, and so we saw it yesterday. There was a whole range of possible views within the movements. Oh, there are also many order members with very different views, and there was a sense of being open to each other's views to create space where you can just communicate openly without judging each other, and there was this very sense of creating an open space where you could just have fun and communicate about each other's views.
Yeah, I think something that's been really valuable for me about this project already, even just preparing for this weekend, was spending time with Divan and Sila Vardin, seeing how really dramatically different our views were on the nature of the Buddhist path and what Buddhism is really teaching, and for there to be a really friendly, warm, open space for making each other's views visible, talking about them and understanding each other. And I think it had a really good harmonising effect, which is very badly needed, both within the movement and within the world generally.
Yeah, and to just back that up, I think the value of this kind of event is that we're promoting and helping to form the engagement with a conceptual structure of clearly thought out ideas within which people can more objectively and intelligently explore their own beliefs and views and understand others. So it facilitates a conversation which is much more profitable and positive, and in a way loving than simply disagreeing. So it's I see philosophy is not only part of the great modernist or Western project of understanding, but feeds into the Buddhist project of bringing awakened values into the world.
And a spiritual friendship. And philosophy is a form of friendship.
It's actually a form of friendship.
Well, we'd better leave it there, because now we're going to go and continue this exercise, this exploration into where does Triratna sit on this spectrum, or maybe where it should sit within the Buddhist...
What kind of Buddhist modernist movement is Triratna?
And what kind of Buddhist modernist movement do we want Triratna to be?
So maybe you can think of that at home to inform your decision, listen to the talks. And yeah, thank you guys for doing this little podcast and for all your input, knowledge and enthusiasm.